This is the weekly podcast from the Journal of Neurosurgery. Hello and welcome. I'm Natalie Pinchem, and I will be reading synopses of five articles published on March 20th, 2015. The topics of the articles featured in this podcast are infection, functional neurosurgery, trauma, and vascular disorders. No additional protection against ventriculitis with prolonged systemic antibiotic prophylaxis for patients treated with antibiotic-coated external ventricular drains by Rory Murphy and colleagues. Studies examining the utility of prolonged systemic antibiotic therapy for the prevention of infections related to external ventricular drains, or EVDs, have been contradictory. No study to date has examined whether this treatment confers additional benefit in preventing ventriculitis when used in conjunction with antibiotic-coated EVDs. The authors report on the results of a prospective performance analysis that they conducted over 4 years to examine the impact of discontinuing systemic antibiotic prophylaxis post-insertion of an antibiotic-coated EVD on rates of catheter-related ventriculitis. The study involved 866 patients. Rates of ventriculitis and other nosocomial infections were compared between the period when systemic antibiotics were administered for the duration of EVD placement, referred to as period 1, and the period when antibiotics were administered only for the peri-insertion period, referred to as period 2. There were 8 cases of ventriculitis for an overall incidence of 0.92%. The rates of ventriculitis did not differ significantly between the two periods, being 1.1% in period 1 and 0.4% in period 2. The rate of nosocomial infections, however, was significantly different, 2% in period 1 versus 0% in period 2. The results of this study suggest that prolonged systemic antibiotic prophylaxis following placement of antibiotic-coated EVDs does not seem to reduce the incidence of catheter-related ventriculitis. In this study, it was associated with a higher rate of nosocomial infection and increased cost. Pallidol stimulation for Holmes tremor, clinical outcomes and single-unit recordings in 4 cases, by Camilla Waldham Kilbane and co-authors. Injury to multiple cortical and subcortical areas has been reported to cause Holmes tremor. Holmes tremor is characterized by irregular, low-frequency tremor occurring at rest, with posture, and with action, often affecting proximal muscles. Medical treatment for Holmes tremor is often unsatisfactory. Several case reports of patients with Holmes tremor successfully treated with lesioning or deep brain stimulation have been previously reported. Most commonly, thalamic deep brain stimulation has been used in these patients. In this retrospective study, the authors report clinical outcomes of 4 patients with medically refractory Holmes tremor treated with pallidol deep brain stimulation at their institution. The average length of follow-up was 34 months, and the mean improvement in an abbreviated tremor rating scale was 79%. Intraoperative microelectrode recordings were performed in the awake state during deep brain stimulation implantation. Neurophysiological findings were compared to findings in pallidol recordings of patients with Parkinson's disease who were previously studied. The mean firing rate was lower both at rest and with action in patients with Holmes tremor compared to recordings of patients with Parkinson's disease. Neuronal oscillations at or near tumor frequency, in other words 2 to 8 Hz, were prominent in both Holmes tremor and Parkinson's disease in the resting state. But in-home tremor were not suppressed by voluntary movement, unlike Parkinson's disease. These results illuminate evolving models of cerebellar basal ganglia interaction. Actual and projected incidence rates for chronic subdural hematomas in United States Veterans Administration and civilian populations. By David Young Balzer and co-workers. Chronic subdural hematomas occur most often in elderly persons. However, precise incidence rates for the United States are unknown. The authors used a regional U.S. Veterans Administration database to determine the actual number of veterans who, over a period of 13 years, had received a radiographic diagnosis and had undergone surgery for chronic subdural hematoma. On the basis of this result and data from outside the United States, the authors then created a mathematical model accounting for age, sex, and alcohol consumption to predict the incidence of subdural hematoma for U.S. Veterans Administration and civilian populations from 2012 through 2040. During the study period, which was from 2000 through 2012, of a total of 875,842 patient visits, 695 new subdural hematomas were identified on CT images. Only 29% of these required surgical drainage. The incidence rate was 79.4 cases per 100,000 persons, and the age standardized rate was 39.1 plus or minus 4.74 cases per 100,000 persons. The authors used this information to create a mathematical model. The model predicts that by 2030, incidence rates for chronic subdural hematoma in aging U.S. Veterans Administration and civilian populations will reach 121.4 and 17.4 cases per 100,000 persons, respectively. In the United States, by 2030, at least 60,000 cases will occur each year, making chronic subdural hematoma the most common cranial neurosurgical condition among adults. Endovascular transvenous cure for ruptured brain arteriovenous malformations in complex cases with high Spetzler-Martin grades. By Christina Josef and colleagues. Ruptured cerebral arteriovenous malformations with deep localization and high Spetzler-Martin grades are associated with considerable challenges regarding nidus eradication treatments. The authors report their experience with curative endovascular transvenous embolization in a series of 20 consecutive patients who harbored ruptured brain arteriovenous malformations that were considered incurable with classic endovascular and surgical techniques. Many of the patients had been partially treated by various previous techniques, and some arteriovenous malformations re-ruptured during the post-procedural period. Therapeutic decision-making was based on Spetzler-Martin grades, arteriovenous malformations location, type of venous drainage, and angioarchitectural evaluation. The goal of the treatment was complete exclusion of the nidus. The draining vein, usually internal cerebral vein, choroidal vein, or the basal vein, was coaxially microcatheted in order to embolize the nidus with non-adhesive liquid embolic agent. The procedure was technically feasible, and the post-procedural clinical status was unchanged for all patients. Procedure-related mortality was 0%. 90% of the patients were independent at their everyday lives after 6 months. In all but one case, the embolization was curative. Endovascular transvenous embolization seems to be a safe and effective single-session curative treatment for patients harboring complex brain arteriovenous malformations with high Spetzler-Martin grades, especially for those with single venous outlet, deep residual arteriovenous malformations. Isolated cortical vein thrombosis, a case series by Runjade Singh and co-authors. Isolated cortical vein thrombosis may cause parenchymal brain damage, rendering early and accurate diagnosis critical. However, the diagnosis remains challenging due to cortical vein anatomical variations, non-specific clinical presentations, and the lack of gold standard imaging modality. This case series of 7 patients with isolated cortical vein thrombosis presents the relevant clinical and radiological findings and highlights risk factors and imaging modalities that may be the most beneficial in rendering an accurate and timely diagnosis. The majority of these patients were adult women. Seizures and headaches were the most common presenting symptoms. Hypercoagulability and intracranial hypertension, both known risk factors for thrombosis, were the most commonly noted risk factors. Intraparenchymal involvement was prevalent in nearly all cases and presented as vasogenic edema, early intraparenchymal hemorrhage, or hemorrhagic venous infarction. Computed tomography suggested the correct diagnosis in 4 patients, and MRI confirmed the diagnosis in all 7 patients, with susceptibility-weighted imaging being the most accurate modality for diagnosis. This case series underscores the importance of obtaining proper imaging, namely susceptibility-weighted imaging, in cases with clinical symptoms and risk factors suggestive of isolated cortical vein thrombosis, and in cases with intraparenchymal hemorrhage, venous congestion, and/or venous infarction of unclear origin. Thank you for listening. JNSPG podcast content is contained in the AANS iTunes U site. Sign up in iTunes for JNSPG and AANS podcasts and videos. Content is updated continuously. Comments on this podcast can be sent to jnspodcast@thejns.org.